Thank you for having me. Can you hear me? I'm very short, so the mic is pointed towards my forehead. So I have a couple things that I'm going to read tonight. I'm going to try not to have any overlap with what I'm going to read tomorrow. So when I was like, oh crap, I have to read for a half hour? Okay, I guess I can read some more stuff. I'm going to read from my book, Carceral Capitalism, which is a hybrid work. It is mostly a collection of essays. Most of them are, I guess, political theory. There's some political economy and analysis of law and discourse. But I basically wrote creative pieces that are interwoven throughout the text to kind of ventilate the text, to take some of the pressure off the theory. So it is also, I guess, a work of creative nonfiction as well. And at the end, I have a piece called The Prison Abolitionist Imagination. So most of the book is very dark and depressing. It's all about prisons and police. But I wanted to think about prison abolition as a poetic project as well, and to try to develop an abolitionist poetics. And I'm very grateful that the people at Semiotext let me just do whatever I want. So I was like, okay, I'll have a piece about RoboCop, and I'll have some poetry at the end. And they're like, yeah, sure, that's fine. So I'll read some excerpts from The Prison Abolitionist Imagination, and I will read one other thing from the book as well. Okay, so this is from The Prison Abolitionist Imagination, A Conversation. The late Mark Fisher once famously said that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. The same could be said about prisons. It is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine a world without prisons. And yet the modern prison as it currently exists in the US is a fairly recent invention. Florida, which now has one of the largest prison systems in the US, had no physical penitentiaries at the end of the Civil War and had to create its penal system from scratch. Yet at this historical juncture, prisons have become thoroughly naturalized. Imagining and working towards a world without prisons, which is the project of prison abolition, would not only require us to fundamentally rethink the role of the state in society, but it would also require us to work toward the total transformation of all social relations. A project as lofty as this is easy to dismiss as unrealistic, utopian, impractical, naive, an unrealizable dream. But what if, instead of reacting to these charges with counterarguments that persuasively demonstrate that the abolitionist position is the only sensible position, we instead strategically use these charges as a point of departure to show how the prison itself is a problem for thought that can only be unthought using a mode of thinking that does not capitulate to the realism of the present? Can the reenchantment of the world be an instrument that we use to shatter the realism of the prison? What follows is a series of questions, conversations with revolutionaries, dead and alive. On death, dreams, the struggle, and the phenomenological experience of freedom. There are moments I want to enter. Will you follow me there, to the place where the breathing walls quietly exhale a low freedom song? 1. The prison is our shadow. In a hypothetical conversation with his jailer, Mahmoud Darwish, a Palestinian poet, writes, You, not I, are the loser. He who lives on depriving others of light drowns in the darkness of his own shadow. You will never be free of me unless my freedom is generous to a fault. Then it would teach you peace and guide you home. You, not I, are afraid of what the cell is doing to me. You who guard my sleep, dream, and a delirium mind with ghosts. I have the vision and you have the tower, the heavy keychain and a gun trained on a ghost. I have sleepiness with its silky touch and essence. You have to stay up watching over me, lest sleepiness take the weapon from your hand before your eyes can see it. Dreaming is my profession, while yours is pointless eavesdropping on an unfriendly conversation between my freedom and me." End quote. The poet prisoner haunts the guard, who becomes a prisoner of his paranoia. The profession of the poet is dreaming. The profession of the jailer is to contain. The poet is the one who makes the light. The guard is the one who takes it. He who lives on depriving others of light drowns in the darkness of his own shadow. Will the ones who built the nightmare also drown in it? The prisoner knows the true meaning of freedom, while the guard knows only how to police this freedom. What does the jailer give up when he becomes an instrument of the state? Does the jailer remember what it means to love, to grieve, to rub the muscles of freedom, or borrow the bird's example? They cannot annihilate what we carry in our hearts and minds, this vision of an elsewhere, or the memory of a bird. How many poets and revolutionaries discovered freedom in a cell? 2. The stars seen from prison. In September 1971, the prisoners of Attica rose up, took the prison, and carved out a small space of freedom, a temporary liberated zone from which they could observe the stars. Heather Ann Thompson, in a history of the Attica uprising, writes, quote, "Despite the sense of foreboding, there were moments of levity and for some even a feeling of unexpected joy as men who hadn't felt the fresh air of night for years reveled in this strange freedom. Out in the dark, music could be heard. Drums, a guitar, vibes, flute, sax that the brothers were playing. This was the lightest many of them had felt since being processed into the maximum security facility. That night was in fact a deeply emotional time for all of them. Carlos Roche watched as tears of elation ran down the withered face of his friend Owl, an old man who had been locked up for decades. You know, Owl said in wonderment, I haven't seen the stars in 22 years. As Clark later described this first night of the rebellion, while there was much trepidation about what might occur next, the men in D Yard also felt wonderful because, quote, no matter what happened later on, they couldn't take this night away from us, end quote. In the cracks of the prison, something bloomed. A field of wildflowers imposed on a night sky. Blood was coming. Joy and dread mingled there, infusing the air with a powerful sense of rapture and uncertainty. What exalted frequency was discovered that night, then lost, when Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered the police to put down the uprising. Blood was coming. The new world never arrived. How terrible it must have been for W.E.B. Du Bois to realize he had mistaken dusk for dawn, that darkness would follow and not the radiance of a new day, his people's strivings rendered crepuscular, the dream of liberation collapsed in a heap of blood-stained rubble. Blood was coming. The drumming would not last. The prisoners would be punished for daring to glimpse the stars. Will those who have constructed this hell ever wonder, what was it all for? The subordination of all life to these systems that hem us in. Why cover the sky? 3, the dialectic of dreaming. Assata Shakur, a black revolutionary who lives in exile in Cuba, writes, quote, "Dreams and reality are opposites. Action synthesizes them," end quote. Before Assata Shakur was liberated from prison, her grandmother and family came to visit her, bearing a dream. "You're coming home soon," her grandmother said. "I don't know when it will be, but you're coming home. You're getting out of here. It won't be too long, though." She went on, "I dreamed we were in our house in Jamaica. I was dressing you, putting your clothes on." Assata's grandmother was known for her prophetic dreams. They came when they were needed, but it was ultimately the responsibility of the recipients of the vision to make them real, not only by believing in the veracity of the prophecies, but by acting so as to give them flesh. When Assata returned to her prison cell, she could not help but dance and sing. She writes, "No amount of scientific, rational thinking could diminish the high that I felt. A tingly, giddy excitement had caught hold of me. I had gotten drunk on my family's arrogant, carefree optimism. I literally danced in my cell singing, 'Feet don't fail me now.' I sang the feet part real low, so I guess the guards must have thought I was bugging out, stomping around my cage singing, 'Feet, feet.'" When we act in accordance with the prophetic dream, the dream comes to directly constitute reality. 4, the rhythm of revolt. Sometimes I don't know what to tell you or how to end. For some time I have been thinking about how to convey the message of police and prison abolition to you. But I know that as a poet, it is not my job to win you over with persuasive arguments, but to impart to you a vibrational experience that is capable of awakening your desire for a new world. A couple of years ago, I saw the Black Arts Movement poet and activist Sonia Sanchez speak. I was moved by the way she would pause whenever she experienced vertigo and spontaneously started singing as a way to find her rhythm after nearly passing out. In a haiku, Sonia writes, "Without your residential breath, I lose my timing. Our bodies are not closed loops. We hold each other and keep each other in time by marching, singing, embracing, breathing. We synchronize our tempo so we can find a rhythm through which the urge to live can be expressed collectively. And in this way, we set the world in motion. In this way, poets become the timekeepers of the revolution." Okay, so I have one more excerpt that I'm going to read. I've never read this before, and this book just came out, so I haven't really done many events for the book yet. Also, thank you to the Poetry Center for having me, and thank you, Lily, for reading with me. Lily and I are tight, so it is an honor to get to read together. Why'd you laugh?
You said we're tight.
We're tight. And this is my little brother, by the way, Danny. He's like, psh, sister's acting up again. It's like, I thought she made it, and now she's just making a fool of herself. So this book, I also think of this book as an exorcism in many ways. Danny and I, we have an older brother who is in prison, and when I was 16, he was given a juvenile life without parole prison sentence, which was recently commuted to 40 years. And so while I was finishing up the book, he had his resentencing hearing. So this section is just a meditation on my life and all of these strange things that have been unfolding in my life in recent years, and kind of thinking about all these things alongside my brother who is in prison in Florida. So this is called Ripples in Time. What is prison? Immobility, yes, but also the manipulation of time as a form of psychic torture, the regimentation of time, the phenomenology of waiting, the agony of juridical limbo, the carceral ripple effect when any life is taken by the state, how it warps the temporalities of everyone in the orbit of the disappeared person. I don't know how time is experienced on the inside of prison. I only know how prison mangles time from the perspective of a family member on the outside looking in. 9 years we sat waiting for my brother's hearing while his appeal sat unread on some courthouse clerk's desk. Time moves on the outside while my brother's situation remained static. We were teenagers when he got locked up, and now he's balding. My life slowly ambles along while my brother's life stands still. My life. After living in a punk house in Baltimore for a couple of years, I ran out of money and decided to move to the desert to escape my abusive relationship and go to poetry school. And I landed at Lily's house in New Mexico. Less than a year later, incapacitated by depression, I dropped out of my MFA program and got a one-way ticket to Glasgow to do a filmmaking workshop for women of color. What would I do next? Chris Krause said I could stay in an apartment for free in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to work on a book for Semiotext. And Semiotext was like, we'll put you up and you can work on your book. And I ended up just applying to grad school instead. But I ultimately delivered on the book because it's here today. I was broke, without a job or a place to live. Nothing for years for my brother, then suddenly time accelerates. A hearing. With this news, we were somewhere else, full of hope, sick to our stomachs, racked with fear. The original trauma rent open, returning all at once. On Christmas Day, I flew to Florida to stay with my parents while waiting for my brother's hearing. What did I have to show for myself? Like my brother, I seemed to be going nowhere too. I returned without a degree. I was a failure, or so my father said. Days before the hearing and a week after I had been deemed a failure by my father, the acceptances to PhD programs started coming in. First from Harvard, then 5 minutes later from NYU's American Studies program. Time accelerates. Life moves in leaps. Where was I? Suddenly thrust forward. I couldn't process it. I couldn't reply to the emails. The professors at the fancy schools were wondering why I wasn't more excited about my acceptances. My father told me that accepting the Harvard offer would redeem the family. Like, I had to literally not answer his phone calls for, like, months because it was... We had been waiting for the hearing for 9 years. When the day finally arrived, I could immediately tell by the judge's body language and the way she bullied my brother on the stand that it was not going well. Then, all at once, our hopes were deflated. The judge determined that the new evidence, which revealed that my brother acted in self-defense when he was being jumped by a group of boys, would not have changed the minds of the jury. That night, my parents stayed up all night arguing about what had gone wrong during the initial trial, about why the evidentiary hearing failed. I stayed awake too, mediating their fight. The old wound vibrating made us all crazy. The next day, on no sleep, I boarded a flight to San Francisco with my little brother to participate in events organized by Mills College. For months, I wandered from city to city until I landed in Cambridge, Massachusetts to attend Harvard. I had a breakdown my first year. It was as though everything I had been trying to outrun finally had a chance to catch up with me. Life stops. Suddenly, it becomes impossible to get out of bed. All you can do is weep. I felt guilty about being at Harvard. I stopped checking my emails. I couldn't do my schoolwork. I stopped living. 3 years into my program, I was finally learning how to live. Meanwhile, my brother was working as a barber in prison. The decisions reached in the Miller versus Alabama and Montgomery versus Louisiana federal Supreme Court cases meant that my brother was entitled to a resentencing hearing. Though over the course of nearly a year, the hearing would be delayed many times. Everything was colored by anxiety. The date would arrive, but the hearing would not happen. The prosecutor promised to offer a deal. Hope stirred once again. The deal never arrived. Over the course of 2 semesters, I would fly to Florida, only to find out at the last minute that the hearing had been canceled. Our lives were punctuated by this anxiety-inducing cycle of anticipation and deferral. Even though my brother, who was usually held in a faraway prison in northern Florida, was nearby in a county jail, we were not allowed to visit him. For weeks leading up to the November hearing date, I was incapacitated. Nothing. Muscles clenched in anticipation. Then, all at once, everything hit. The night before flying to Florida for the hearing, I was sexually assaulted by a sleazy Nietzsche scholar from the German Studies graduate program, and I will never trust Nietzsche scholars ever again. Still reeling from the assault and a recent breakup, I dragged myself to the airport. My father picked me up at the Tampa airport. It was night. I was now in Trump territory, though he had not yet been inaugurated. On the drive home, while my father was weepily talking about the death of Joe Biden's son, I too have lost a son. My father crashed the car into a deer that leapt in front of us. Time stood still. After what seemed like an eternity, my father blurted out in his thick Chinese accent, "Oh my God, I killed a deer." Why was I wet? Had the blood of the deer somehow gotten into the car? I smelled like cigarettes. After sniffing the strange liquid, I remembered that in the cup holder next to the driver's seat, my mother kept a half-empty cup of old coffee with cigarette butts floating in it. When I got to my parents' house, my mother informed me that the hearing had been canceled again. Exhausted, I requested a Xanax, made a tweet about the car accident, then retired to my childhood bedroom. Someone replied to my tweet that an activist had recently died after hitting a deer while on the way to Standing Rock. A week later, I found out it was my friend Clark who died in that crash. Juridical limbo is the extension of time within a context of uncertainty. The manipulation of time becomes a way to psychically wear someone down. How did my brother experience it in the context of a juvenile life without parole sentence? How does someone experience the passing of time when he's condemned to live out his entire adult life in prison? Still, we waited for the prosecutor to make a deal. If the deal came through, I would not have to fly to Florida again to testify as a character witness. I asked my mom, should I buy my ticket anyway? We were getting close to the date of the hearing. We didn't want to go to the hearing, for we knew that Judge Ballone was a hanging judge and had initially resentenced a juvenile lifer to life again. The deal never came. I flew to Florida in the morning to look respectable in the court of law. I covered my green hair with a brown spray that my father used to cover up his baldness. I had this like brown stuff flaking off me, so I'm not sure how respectable I actually looked. The lawyer said she might call me to the stand to testify first, but when I got to the courthouse, the psychologist was already testifying about my brother's mental disabilities caused by an anoxic brain injury suffered at birth. The judge was not paying attention. He was not even looking at the witness. Then it was the prosecutor's turn to make a statement. He was a young man who seemed completely indifferent to the case, not like the bloodthirsty madman, Halkaitis, who had initially prosecuted my brother. When the new prosecutor reviewed the details, he was all mixed up about the basic facts of the case. It occurred to me that he had probably not even read the file at all. Then it was my brother's lawyer's turn to make a statement. While she was talking, the prosecutor stood up to offer a deal. The lawyer went over to the prosecutor to discuss the terms with him. 40 years. When the lawyer went over to give my brother the news, I watched my brother cry out in agony, weep with his head in his hands. 40 years. And then the lawyer said, but you won't die in prison. And then my brother said, but maybe we should continue with the hearing. And the lawyer said, imagine you have just stuck the key in the ignition of a car. And if you turn it, there is a 1 in 3 chance the car will blow up. Are you going to turn the key? He had to decide, would he gamble his life and turn the key? No, he accepted the deal. As the lawyer worked out the details with the prosecutor, I looked over at my brother. There he sat in chains, wearing an orange jumpsuit. I watched him while weeping. The father of the Palestinian Egyptian family who lived across the street from us was weeping too. And in front of us was the stone cold judge I had testified in front of 12 years earlier when I was a high schooler. Now I was a Harvard PhD student, but part of my life has stood completely still. For months after the hearing, whenever my brother called from prison, he would ask me if he made the right decision by accepting the deal. Thank you.